Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. A little more reality than usual this time, huh?
Well, kind of.
Kind of, that's right. Yes and no. Good story. This is episode 159, and we're going to talk about Inherit the Wind, which is a movie from 1960. I guess I could say about the Scopes monkey trial is what they call it, although it wasn't really. I mean, it wasn't, you know, none of the characters have the same names or anything like that, which is an interesting thing. But yet it was marketed that way, wasn't it?
Yes, and when I was reading up on the Scopes trial, which I had only the vaguest knowledge of, it looks like much of the trial actually is based on the Scopes trial and some of the dialogue, a lot of the dialogue even. So it is in a way, but all the stuff around the edges, all the other stuff is added.
Oh, okay.
So,
and Hollywood does that a lot, don't they?
Sure.
Yeah.
Because it's that thing of, it's the real story based on a real story, but what is the movie's point of view? It's like painting.
Yeah.
How are you painting this and what are you saying about it? And this was, the play was written in 1955, and the authors of the play, I believe, or author, specifically said they were thinking of the, the blacklisting and the McCarthy hearings.
Really? Okay, that's news
to
me.
Yeah, that adds
it does another, make sense, but yeah.
Right. And so it adds another tweak, because I know that when I went to read up on the movie after watching it, one of the first things the Wikipedia page says, and the movie says too, is this isn't a historical document. But yet, it's marketed that way. You know it's linked to the Scopes trial. You know almost nothing about the Scopes trial. So we're back at the question of where does the responsibility of the filmmaker to the truth go in how it's represented?
Right, right.
Which is like any artist, where does the, how much do you have to do it faithfully? Because it's not a documentary.
Yeah. And even documentaries have a point of view, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's like, you know, you're not going to make a perfect representation. There is going to be bias.
Right. Unless you're reading the transcripts of the trial.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
agreed.
Why did you pick the movie? It was an interesting choice.
Well, I picked the movie. My daughter actually watched this at school, and I had not seen it. So she said, "Dad, I think you'd like this one." So I watched it, and I was like, "Yeah, that's fairly interesting." And I wanted to talk about it because, I think it's so relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like a lot of people, let's just use the word reject. A lot of people reject Christianity based on things that they think that they know that aren't even true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, positions that they believe that the Catholic Church takes, for example, that aren't true. So one of those things, and we're 159 episodes in, and in 100 of those episodes, I've probably mentioned science and religion.
Right.
But here goes one more time. You know, it perplexes me that there is this prevailing belief, especially among new atheists and a lot of people that follow them, that science and religion are incompatible.
Yeah.
It's a perplexing point of view. And I think that it's one that is based on a misunderstanding of at least, you know, Catholic Christianity.
Well, and I would say a lot of Christianity, especially these days, because, you know, a lot of people, I think, take their view of believers from the attitudes that we're shown in this movie, which is one of the things that when you're reading Wikipedia, they say the townspeople weren't hostile.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't have these things going on. There was no girlfriend. There was, you know, whatever. So that representation, though, is based on a stereotype.
Right.
And that stereotype, because of the power of media and everything else, anytime you experience someone who is closed-minded, who's a believer and all that kind of thing, it just builds up and you believe that no one is going to have an open mind. And as we were watching it, as you say, Rose watched it with me, and we kept going, isn't this interesting? Because for us, we almost felt like you could stage this modern day and flip the positions.
Mm.
Because what we have come across, and maybe it's just a media representation, but in people that we've met and know, they are often as closed-minded in terms of anything you might have to say about religion. They don't want to hear your witnesses. They don't want to look at anything else. They're the ones who are saying, nope, that doesn't have anything to do with this. I'm not going to listen to a word you say.
Yeah.
And
it's become normal.
Right. And they're just as aggrandizing as the prosecutor Brady, who is like, I know the Bible and that's good enough for me. And they're like, here's my scientific attitude and that's good enough for me. And so nobody's examining both sides. So it was just interesting watching that and thinking how public attitudes have shifted in that time period.
That is a fascinating observation, and I do agree with you. And you have to admit, when you see this, that, and you've said before how, we think we live in really unique times, and we continue to think about that. But you are one of the people that's told me, hey, this is not as unique as you think it is. The United States has always been in turmoil. I mean, when has there been a calmness? Even in the 50s, which we normally feel is, the calm time, right? We won the war, everything's great. But, in there you've got the Korean War. You've got all kinds of social turmoil going on. Mm-hmm. You've got McCarthy running around, which is, an aspect of this that you told me right before we started that I didn't know. And please fill us in on that.
Oh, the thing about the filmmakers. Yeah. Well, not the filmmakers. This film is from a play, which mm-hmm. was written in 1955. So for one thing, the Scopes trial was in 1925. So then you have the 1955 play, and they said that they deliberately wrote it thinking about McCarthyism. So you've got a real definite point of view going on.
Yeah.
And in a sense, it's funny because this director, Stanley Kramer, produced High Noon, which a lot of people said also was about McCarthy trial, standing alone for the right thing when everybody else is afraid to say anything. This doesn't have exactly that attitude. It's got, the people who can't think for themselves, the sheep who are being led by bad shepherds, essentially. But because they were writing it about the McCarthy trials, they have that point of view.
Yeah, and that's an interesting aspect to this. So, they're feeling put upon, so they're going to go ahead and do this and they're going to make, the Christian side of it seem even more mm-hmm. out of whack than it is. But the thing is, I feel like the Christian point of view in this trial is completely out of whack.
Well, and in fact, and I can't remember if I already said this or if it was when we were talking before, but the Wikipedia page was saying that, the townspeople weren't hostile. They didn't have the lynching idea. Mm. In fact, the whole trial, the Scopes trial, one of the things I objected to about the movie until I was reading up on the Scopes trial was I was like, no one seems to be trying the case.
Mm.
He did teach evolution. We saw him do it. If that's against the law, then he did it. But what happened actually is that the ACLU kind of pushed the point to make this to make the Scopes trial a trial of the law itself. So it was as was represented in the movie. And the teacher was actually like a substitute teacher. And when they asked him about evolution, the ACLU, he said, well, I don't know if I taught evolution, but I did look at the evolutionary charts and we talked about all this stuff. And they said, that's good enough. We'll push that you did this and put you out there. And so it turned into this huge media circus, essentially, because everybody wanted to see what was going to happen when religion versus evolution came to trial. And then at the same time, you had it being covered by all the media, of course. And H.L. Mencken was the main journalist. And I don't know if you know much about him. I know just a little, but he was just, for one thing, he was an atheist, but he also just had the most pointed sense of humor. He would skewer anybody, and he was really well known. And so Gene Kelly in this movie is H.L. Mencken. I'm reading it going, oh, that's H.L. Mencken. That's why he was the way he was.
Interesting. Yeah. And his name in the movie, I'm looking at the cast list, is E.K. Hornbeck.
Yeah.
Interesting. So they kind of patterned his name anyway.
Yeah. And when I was looking at the, so then I went and looked also, and they said, as H.L. Mencken, essentially.
Really?
Yeah. And so the guy, oh gosh, Brady is not the name, but the real life person who they call Brady in the movie, who ran three times for president and all this kind of thing, he was really eager to defend, you know, the Bible. He really was. And then Clarence Darrow, whose name we all know is a great lawyer, maybe not a great person, but a, you know, big lawyer, was not eager to do it, but he was kind of pushed into it.
Hmm.
So
very interesting. Why do you think that they made the movie with different names for everybody?
I have no idea, because if they're lifting parts of the, and everybody knows what it is. It's being promoted, right? With monkeys in the poster and everything.
Yeah.
What'd that poster have on it?
Yeah, it says, it's all about the fabulous monkey trial that rocked America.
Right.
But it doesn't say Scopes anywhere on the front or anything like that. And the Scopes monkey trial, like you said, happened in 1925. So, I don't know. I find that really interesting that they would have... you know, maybe they felt like that gave them license to do whatever they wanted.
Well, they also changed, but they changed enough things that they probably felt like it was fictionalized, you know, because the school teacher in the movie is actively teaching evolution because he passionately believes that he should have the right to teach both things.
Yeah.
It's a truth that could be out there. And so why are you shutting a mind and that kind of thing, which is, I say that like that. But I'm absolutely in favor of that, of course. But it's, you know, so passionate. And when the townspeople go and, you know, they're all gathering up, and it's like watching a bunch of bandits or a posse or something as they all gather each other in their straw hats to go stand in the back of the classroom so that they can serve the warrant of arrest on him. And it's just a lot of that stuff is very over the top.
Yeah.
But they've changed it. You know, they've clearly changed it. It is a work of fiction, but it's so much based on and identified with that Scopes trial that people are going to take it as real no matter what.
Agreed.
I found it interesting that the trial was, he did get, well, okay, spoilers for anyone who doesn't know. You know, the fine was $100, and it was overturned on a technicality in a higher court. But, and the technicality, but eventually Tennessee rescinded their law, and the Supreme Court ruled either on that, or I think it was a different law that basically said, what you're doing here is promoting a state religion, because all the kinds of Christianity don't necessarily agree with what this law says. And they specifically named Roman Catholics among those. Among those that did not. When it was appealed, what the court said was that the Tennessee Religious Preference Clause was designed to prevent the establishment of a state religion, as had been the experience in England and Scotland at the writing of the Constitution. And so the argument that was being rejected was that, you know, they could not give a preference to any religious establishment or mode of worship. And so they are saying, they're talking about the theories of evolution, and it says examination of these contributions indicates that Protestants, Catholics, and Jews are divided among themselves in their beliefs, and that there is no unanimity among the members of any religious establishment as to this subject. Belief or unbelief in the theory of evolution is no more a characteristic of any religious establishment or mode of worship than is belief or unbelief in the wisdom of the prohibition laws. It would appear that members of the same churches quite generally disagree as to these things. And so, anyway.
Yeah.
And that's pulled a bit out of context. So, you know, but I just thought it was interesting that there's like, look.
That is very interesting to me. I didn't know that.
And they do give a line in the movie where they go, you know, Christians outside the state believe other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so they kind of open that door a little.
Wow. Yeah.
But usually what we're seeing is fundamentalists. And interestingly, I was reading something that was talking about after the Scopes trial, fundamentalism became a term that was used in the United States for a certain kind of religious belief. Before that, it wasn't so much. And evangelical was linked with that. And it took Billy Graham to bring it back, evangelicals, into something that was more mainstream and considered to be something that could be good instead of super radical.
Gotcha.
Gotcha. So that would have also been the framework for this. Everybody would have gone, oh, those fundamentalists, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a word that I grew up with, you know, fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a challenge to my faith, period. You know, probably one of the reasons why I left the church when I was so young was these very reasons, you know, that I'm like, well, Christianity believes X. And you only realize, you know, so it's personal to me, too. I didn't realize until much later that, oh, that's not really true. You know, so a lot of the things that a lot of the arguments that the new atheists put forward have to do with fundamentalism as well. They use fundamentalism as, you know, this is what Christianity believes. They basically pick and choose whatever they want to attack.
Well, and it's kind of interesting to me. I was really stunned when I was with a family member, and we had taken kids to a zoo, so our kids were pretty young, so this had been not that long ago, you know, since my kids are in their mid-20s. And the kids were off, and the other mother and I were kind of watching the gorillas or something, and she was raised Catholic, has left the church essentially, as far as I can tell, but still very religious, very faithful. I mean, I admire this person a lot. But she suddenly really stunned me by saying, no one can tell me that I'm descended from a gorilla. And I was like, what? You actually, this is your understanding of evolution? I mean, and this is not an uneducation. This is not an uneducated or even an older person. I was like, well, okay, so evolution, here we go, and time as known to God and known to us. And so I actually went into the very argument that winds up getting used later in this movie.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just kind of one of those things, and I don't know if that bore any fruit or not. We just kind of had that little conversation and then didn't talk about it anymore. But I was stunned that here we were in modern times and somebody had that understanding of what science teaches as opposed to faith.
Yeah. And if you were to watch this movie and then that's where your knowledge of evolution came from, it would also be incorrect, wouldn't it? You know,
oh, yeah.
Because well, they're saying, well, you're descended from a monkey, and that's not what they say. That's not what evolution says.
Right. For one thing, so the representation is of the extreme understandings, or, you know, and limited understandings, because that's also the idea of the Bible as literal, factual truth. Every bit of it is something that has really not ever been part of general Catholic teachings.
It's a collection of books, and they're all like different genres.
And it's about faith. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily science, and but it's got history in it, but it's always shown through the eyes of faith. Who are we? Who is God? How do we intersect? What does this mean for our lives? I mean, that's what the whole Bible is looking at. And, you know, I mean, some of it's unalterable actual history and some of it's very poetic, but it's, you know, fiction, as you say. And it tells a truth, but it tells a truth in a way that facts can't sometimes.
Right. Yeah, but, which is why Jesus himself uses parables, right?
Right.
Somehow they speak to us differently.
Yeah.
There's a depth in the story, right, that has many, many layers. You know, he could say XYZ, but that's not what he chose to do. He said, let me tell you a story.
Yeah, because we're wired that way. He knows that. He made us. I mean,
you want to go back to the beginning. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. You know, why are we wired that way? I think that's a fascinating thing. In the beginning was the word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love that thought.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a unique thing about human beings.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure.
So one thing when we're talking, I mean, I know at some point we have to talk about the movie, but one thing is...
Well, like the movie, we're talking about what we're hammer doing exactly what the movie does. Yeah.
Anyway, I've got my hammer and I'm not afraid to use it.
I love it.
But I did want to say that in terms of people thinking that now religion has evolved to have a better understanding of how science and religion can go together. And in the old days, everybody was like these fundamentalists, and no one thought and no one ever looked any deeper than here's what scripture says. I believe we have a reading from St. Augustine of Hippo.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I've got it right here.
Who was a big seeker after truth, and his search was that he wanted to know, capital T truth, there must be something that explains everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, and I'll read this. This is from a document called De Genesi Ad Literam, which I'm sure I did not say correctly. It means the literal meaning of Genesis, by St. Augustine. And he says, often, a non-Christian knows something about the earth, the heavens, and the other parts of the world, about the motions and orbits of the stars, and even their sizes and distances. And this knowledge he holds with certainty from reason and experience. It is thus offensive and disgraceful for an unbeliever to hear a Christian talk nonsense about such things, claiming that what he is saying is based in Scripture. We should do all we can to avoid such an embarrassing situation, which people see as ignorance in the Christian and laugh to scorn. The shame is not so much that an ignorant person is laughed at, but rather that people outside the faith believe that we hold such opinions, and thus our teachings are rejected as ignorant and unlearned. If they find a Christian mistaken in a subject that they know well, and hear him maintaining his foolish opinions as based on our teachings, how are they going to believe these teachings in matters concerning resurrection of the dead, the hope of eternal life, and the kingdom of heaven, when they think that these teachings are filled with fallacies about facts which they have learnt from experience and reason? Reckless and presumptuous expounders of Scripture bring about much harm when they are caught in the mischievous false opinions by those not bound by a sacred text, and even more so when they then try to defend their rash and obviously untrue statements by quoting a shower of words from Scripture and even recite from memory passages which they think will support their case without understanding either what they are saying or what they assert with such assurance. And that last part is from 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7. That you sent right? that to me, 5 days ago, says my email. Yeah. And I don't think I've come across that before. And I was just like, unbelievable.
Yeah.
When did he write that? I mean, this is...
Well, his life was in the
400s. Yeah, 400 AD. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. Wow. He spent his whole life trying to understand up to his conversion, which was in his 30s. But so from the time of reason, essentially, he was always looking for what's true. And so he wound up spending a lot of time with the Manichees, and they had this interesting mythology they had created based on the idea of good and evil, but it didn't fit everything, and no one could defend it. And Augustine was a trained master of rhetoric, so he understood all this, and he would reject the Bible at different times. Because St. Monica was his mother, who was a practicing Christian, and he'd come across other people, and he'd go, and he'd look and go, well, I'm going to try Scripture. They say this. And he'd go, oh my gosh, the style is the worst. Who can read this stuff? Or then he'd go, look what they're saying. They're idiots. And he knew what all his pagan friends, which was the religion of the time, would say, which is, you know, those dummies, they think that God has hair and fingernails because they're created in God's image. Well, you know, being super literal, this is what they were saying. So he understood exactly how it looks from the outside. So once he came across St. Ambrose of Milan, all these people were sainted later, obviously, who was the bishop, who explained, no, no, here's how you read scripture on a deeper level. It's talking about us and our lives also. It's talking about these things. He went, oh. So he went back and started rereading with this new way of looking at it and went, oh, hold on. This is all making a lot more sense.
Mm-hmm.
And but he wrote that when he wrote that, it was obviously after he converted and I believe after he was a bishop, and he was having to deal with all kinds of people. In the people in his care, the people who were attacking, you know.
Yeah.
And he was just such a genius at putting it that way because he'd been on the other side for so long. He knew how it looked. And I came across that soon after I converted and went, yes, thank you.
Yeah, it's just so well put. It's really, really great.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I don't know if you're aware, I used to be on a school board.
And, oh, yeah.
And one, yeah. I had one experience with something similar to what's being talked about here.
Yeah.
Where there was a fellow who wanted me to read all of the textbooks that everybody uses, searching for things like evolution and things like that. And this was in the, this was in the, this was in a bad way. He wanted it out. You know, so he was like, yeah. So it's like, so this is not dead. I mean, this, you know, trying to make sure of that. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's, you know, Augustine puts it so perfectly, you know, that, you know, and I would extend that to parents. You know, if you have a parent who doesn't want their child exposed to any idea that might not be in keeping with what they hold.
Yeah.
That is really a dangerous, dangerous position. Not only that, but you're not preparing them to be in the world. You know, if you're protecting their Christianity by keeping them from hearing anything that's not Christianity, then when they do go out in the world, it's going to be a very, very big surprise. I don't think they'll be prepared to handle that, you know?
Well, exactly. And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, when you said that, this same person I was talking about earlier with evolution would not allow her children to read the Harry Potter books. And this was at a time when they were coming out, all their friends were reading them. She's like, well, no, it's got magic in it. And I was like,
yeah, I just don't understand that either.
Children were so envious of mine, their cousins, because we read them together, you know, until everybody got older and the books got super big. Then we all just passed them around as fast as possible. Because you have to think and discuss things.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what disturbs me when we talk about today, where I feel like a lot of times it's flipped. The other side also won't discuss things.
Yeah, agreed.
I know who you are. I know what you think. You're the worst. We're open-minded. Yeah,
to be fair, I had one call also on that school board from a person who I did not know. So it was an anonymous person. And he was upset that they were teaching. There was a class in the middle school that was teaching religions. Meaning, here's the world religions. They had a semester. Right. Here's the world's religions. And he was upset about that. And I didn't know if he came from a religious background or a non-religious background. But I can see him coming from a non-religious background as easily as I could see him coming from a religious background.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't delve into who he was. I was like, okay, yeah, I'll look into that. You know, see you later. I mean, what are you going to say?
Well, you can't. Well, and instead of looking at it and just saying, what does this show us about people? What are the things in common or different? It's like learning about somebody who lives in India and how their life is as opposed to our life. It can be an eye-opening thing. It can allow you to examine how you live.
Agreed. And that's why the term free thinker is such a difficult one for me because, you know, atheists often use that word.
Mm-hmm.
They say, you know, okay, I am a free thinker, and therefore that means that I am open to everything, right? Which is what the term is supposed to mean, but they're not. they're actually closed. To a great number of things.
Well, and so probably we should talk about the movie some, but I would say that's the
This is what the movie is about, right?
Well, I know, but that's the whole thing. That's what I was going to say. That's what the whole movie is about, is the closed mind. And the people who are saying I'm a free thinker and I won't believe in, you know, I won't settle down to anything. That's what these people are afraid of, is once you open your mind to everything, all the stuff that they feel is true and important flies out the door. And the free thinkers, of course, are not free thinkers. They have their own beliefs that they firmly hold to. That was another one of the things that Augustine discovered, is even people who said that they didn't have believe anything, they didn't have faith in anything, actually had things that they had faith in. They just didn't see it as faith, but they had inalienable truths that they would defend to the end because they believed them.
Right.
Yeah. And that's the case here. And in fact, that's what I liked, is that, and of course, this is representing the trial. They're heavily weighted on the side of despising anybody who's religious because they're not presented with much nuance. But by the same token, Gene Kelly, who does a knockout job of acting, I was pleased to see, plays the sarcastic, cynical, atheist journalist who is delighting in skewering everyone, and he is equally as bad.
He realizes that too at the end, right?
Well, yeah, because I keep wanting to call him Darrow, whatever the guy's name is. Spencer Tracy.
Yeah, Drummond, Spencer Tracy, who I love, by the way. I just love that guy.
Yeah. He's wonderful.
He really is great.
And he's especially effective in this, in his rumpled, tired, sweaty way, although they're all sweating.
Yeah.
I was hot and tired during the whole trial.
You bet. I assume that was a detail from the actual Scopes trial.
It must be.
Otherwise, I'm not sure why they would have done that.
Yeah.
It was really uncomfortable.
Yes.
Everybody is so hot. Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, I liked Drummond. I liked Gene Kelly as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, Matthew Harrison Brady, he was an interesting character. And it was, yeah, I do have to completely admit bias against Brady throughout the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I like how you put that. There was really no nuance to any of the real Christian characters in there. They were all very black and white.
Yeah.
And shown as a hero was... you know, an example of a hero in the movie was the parents of this boy who, was brought up in the trial, who had died, without being baptized. And the reverend in the town, you know, said that the boy was in hell or something like that. And, their parents were held up as a hero in the movie because he stepped forward with his whole farm to basically bail this guy out because he was being held in contempt of court. Drummond was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, I mentioned all that just to show, again, this is the bias of the film. This is the ones that were the heroes were the ones that were bucking the system, right? They were,
yes,
they were against the tide.
Right. So the school teacher, his girlfriend, who they show her conflict. She's the minister's daughter, of course.
Yeah.
And so she's been raised under this very rigid way of thinking. And he's kind of, the teacher has kind of opened her mind. And they show her conflict, her internal conflict. And also, though, there were some places where nuance was shown. And to me, those were the most interesting and effective parts of the movie. And so the fact that Drummond and Brady, the two lawyers, were longtime friends.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the end, Brady's zeal for his faith, and also what they show is his cocksure self-righteousness that's presented as false humility, is his downfall.
Mm-hmm.
And so the pain that putting him on trial does to his friend, you know, they're in the heat of the battle, but because no other evidence is being allowed, no scientific evidence is being allowed, then the only recourse is to put the Bible expert on trial, and that's the other attorney. And that actually really happened.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, and he just had to grind him down.
Oh, about that.
Yeah, which is what they show as he gradually – as he just goes against, well, what about this in the Bible? What about that? So you're saying these are literal? You're saying these things? And even then, outside of the trial, you see the pain it causes. You know, because these good friends become essentially enemies over these ideals. Mm. How many times does that happen in real life? So I liked that. I also really loved Brady's wife. Mm. It was kind of like the bridge between the two men. She was always trying to kind of moderate her husband a little bit, but she was still proud of him. And she was friends with, she could be the friend with Drummond, who, when they're both on opposite sides and mad at each other, she could still understand his point of view also some.
Yeah.
You know, that because they were friends. And so when they have this one scene where the girlfriend of the teacher goes to talk to Brady, the trial lawyer, the prosecutor, because she told him things in confidence, and then he betrayed her in court. He used them as evidence. Mm-hmm. And she's so mad, and she wants to yell at him, but he's sick. He's been worn down by the trial. He's lying down resting, and the wife won't let him in. And so they have this conversation where she's like, you know, he's evil, he's this, and the wife's going, hold the phone now. You can't blame him for this stuff. She's like, I can too. She's like, well, I've lived with him for 40 years. I understand him much more. You see everything in black and white, and you can't blame him for what you said. You know, yeah, maybe he didn't use it right. And so then she says, do you believe in Bertram Cates? And that's the boyfriend. Hmm. I believe in my husband. What do you believe in? Because this girl is allowing herself to be first influenced by her father, then by her boyfriend, then by Brady. She's like, figure out what you think and who you love. Stand up for it. She goes, I believe in my husband, because she's watched him over 40 years or 30 years, however long they've been married. She knows his good and bad side, because she's like, he's not a sinner. He's not a saint. He's a man. He's good and bad. We all are. And that's one of the truest things that the movie says.
Yeah, that was something. Yeah. Yeah, I was struck by that scene as well. Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, an aspect of it I hadn't thought of was how the girlfriend, you know, was being sort of just tossed around by the wind, right? And then because she didn't take a stand at any point.
Right.
Until that point, you know, where she was saying, that's what you need to do, is you need to decide what you're about, right?
Yeah, you can't blame other people now. You're right. A grown up.
Yeah.
Think about it. What right. do you believe?
And I also enjoyed Drummond's conversation with Brady right before the trial started. They were both together on the rocking chairs.
Yes.
That was
yes.
a really good scene. But one of the things that was said there struck me as something that would be said today. Mm-hmm. They said, you know, I think Brady said, well, we've grown apart. Or how did you leave me? Or how did you grow apart from me? Or something like that. And then Drummond said, well, you know, that's relative. You know, maybe you've just stood still, right?
Maybe you left me by standing still,
which is another way of saying, you know, I've progressed, mm-hmm. which is a word we hear all the time nowadays, you know, progressives and everybody mm-hmm. else is standing still, but we're moving forward, and that's the virtue. Mm-hmm. So that's something that that caught my eye as well.
Yeah, exactly. Because the interesting thing is we've all got to do that. It's one thing, and this isn't probably that unique, but I always remember that my priest will say is, if you're not continually swimming, you get swept back by the tide. You know, we're all in this river.
Yeah.
So you have to keep moving. And it doesn't mean that you're necessarily changing your point of view, but it's the growing, it's the learning, it's the deepening, it's the looking below the surface. Because if Brady had done that and had a bit broader view, he would have looked at religion in a bit more nuanced way. He would have at least been able to kind of go, well, you know, you got a good point there. Now, he wouldn't have in the trial because he was dug in, and that's how it was, and he was on display too. With his clever wordplay. And it was funny because he was really good at taking things and kind of making, flipping the words around and making wordplay. And we were out of town this weekend and driving through the Texas countryside, and we'd go by all these little churches, almost all of which were Protestant. And so many of them had very clever, funny sayings on their little kiosks outside the door. You know, we've all been by those. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's exactly what he was doing. And it's not that it was unique, but that was his trademark. And I was like, oh, it's just like that guy. Just like flipping it around.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like what you said there about, not being able to say, yes, that was a good idea. Mm-hmm. That's what we who have entrenched ourselves often lose. You know, that's one of the first things we lose is, you know, we're in an argument and we can't say, you're right about that. You know, I think that we've lost a lot of ability to do that, or it takes a special strength to be able to do that. I think that doesn't seem to be in, you know, we don't have a plentiful source of that right now.
Flexibility.
And that's exactly what it is. It's like, you know, we can disagree on this thing, but we can agree on this thing, and maybe we should focus on that thing and get that done. And then, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, because a lot of times the basic tenet or the basic intention of what's being argued about is something everybody agrees on. It's just that they're coming at it from different angles, and no one will stop to walk halfway around and look at the room from a different point of view.
Yeah.
Even just to say, I can't agree with you, but I do see where you're coming from. Here's why I can't agree. Or here's what, you know, strikes me as a problem. Because even sometimes we feel like we have to win every argument a lot of times. And this is, I think, an American trait, you know, or maybe it's a human trait. But what a lot of times, just expressing uncertainty is enough. Just going, well, you know, I hadn't thought about that before. Let me think about it and get back to you. You don't have to settle everything then.
Yeah, I agree. Because then that gives you both time to think about it.
Right. Everybody can stop and kind of take a breath. Or even if you don't take a breath and you come back just hammer and tongs from the same point of view, you're at least going, okay, I start to see where they're coming from. Because you can't win any argument, for one thing, if that's what you want to do, if you can't answer the other person's objections. And that's what in this movie, Barrow, is that his name? Darrow,
yeah.
Clarence Darrow is the...
Drummond.
Drummond, thank you, I'm sorry. I should write down the fake names. but he has to do that. He has to come and argue on the other person's ground.
Yeah, because they keep not letting him bring up, what Darwin actually had to say.
Right.
Yeah.
We're not going to let those get entered into the court records.
For sure. What did you think of, at the very end, another very, very interesting conversation was between Drummond and Hornbeck. So Mencken and Darrow, right? I thought that was really good stuff.
It was, because surprisingly, you know, they kept calling him Drummond an atheist. And when I looked up, Darrow himself was an agnostic, and that's more of the way he's portrayed at the end. And basically, he loved Brady as a friend for so long that he could kind of see both sides. He understood where he was coming from in his desperation, and the fact that Mencken, or what's his name, Hornbeck or whatever, Gene Kelly, is so intolerant. But he yet recognizes the value of somebody who will argue for any side to try to get them off. He's like, well, if they accuse me of whatever, you'll be there to defend me. Or being if I'm lonely,
you'll
be there to defend me.
Yeah. Was there any truth to the death of Brady?
He died 5 days after the trial, and nobody knew if it had anything to do with the trial or not.
Wow. Okay. So interesting. That's very interesting. But yeah.
That shot they gave was very, interesting, wasn't it? Where it's above the fan, so it's like God looking down at the dead person.
Right, right.
Essentially.
Yeah. I did think that was interesting, too. But on that conversation between Drummond and Hornbeck, I thought that was fascinating. And Hornbeck, you know, was like, wait a minute. You know, the atheist that believes in God.
Mm-hmm.
But that was super interesting. And then his attitude, you know, changed right there where, you know, what was circling in his head. And I saw Roger Ebert. I read his review of this, mm-hmm. and it was mentioned, I think, in Wikipedia too, that when Drummond left at the very end of the movie, he took both books with him.
Right.
Right. The Bible and Darwin. And, you know, you could see that a couple of ways. You know, you could see that as, well, is he getting ready for the next trial and needs them both? Or is that a symbolic, these things can be together? Which is the way I like to take it, because I believe that.
Well, I actually think that's kind of what was indicated. I know I saw that uncertainty floated out there, like you could take it either way. And I was like, to me, there was no question, because he kind of looks at both and weighs them in his hands with this little smile. And then he claps them both together and puts them under his arm and walks out. You don't feel like he's ready for another trial.
Yeah.
There's no reason to feel like he's not, you know, and now here I go, ready to defend the truth wherever it is, because that's not what's indicated by his last talk with Gene Kelly.
No, it isn't.
He's a much more moderate thinker, and he's kind of he could go see both sides. And so I kind of felt like he saw value in both things, because for one thing, for the real trial, evidently they had scientists practice with Darrow going, okay, here's how they'll answer this question, but you can bring this up about for the thing about the earth standing still for 3 days because of Joshua's battle. But in the movie, which is what we're talking about, what we're shown is he's kind of looking at the Bible and he gets this genius idea of, here's what I'm going to question. Well, he has to know the Bible well enough to know those stories. They're all fairly well known.
Yeah, yeah.
But he still has to know those stories. So he has at least a nodding acquaintance with the Bible.
Yeah. Had to have had.
Yeah.
Yep. Agreed.
I am. Did you have more you wanted to say?
No, go right ahead. No.
I also really found the townspeople's point of view interesting. I mean, you have the mob, of course, but at the beginning, when they're talking about what do? They're like, well, you know, this is a problem. Our kids are going to want to go to college in places where they're going to know they're from here, and they're not going to let them in because they're going to think they're dumb. And what about business? We're going to have a hard time doing business because people are going to look down on us. So they're represented as being, you know, just these fundamentalists and God is everything, but they're really also thinking about themselves and their business. And at the end, what makes the judge very moderate is he's reminded essentially, re-elections are going to be coming up. What are you going to do? So it's always about, November isn't too far off, you know?
Yeah, I heard that too.
Yeah, so they begin with the business and end with their personal worries. So their religion, as fundamentalist as it is, it only takes them so far. And so not only are the townspeople not allowed to have any nuance to their faith, they're also hypocritical. At least those people are hypocritical too. So, oh, thank you. You know, at least the journalist is portrayed as being a true believer. This subset of people aren't even true believers.
Agreed. Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't really taken it that way, but you're right. Yeah, it's like the faith is secondary to all these other concerns that they've got.
Right.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
Yeah, well, they're like, well, we got to go on and live, too.
Yeah, and then they've even got, you know, the more extreme people, you know, like this song, you know, the songs in this movie are like earworms. It's horrible.
I was like, I did not want to hear that ever again.
Yeah. Never again. But yeah, there was like this older lady that was in the courtroom, you know.
The knitting lady, we called.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
She just yells stuff. Oh my gosh.
Man, you say it.
Brady, you are like the, she called him a prophet. Yeah. He was a prophet of God.
Yeah. That was the dangerous part that we're shown in these people being held above God, essentially, because at one point when they're kind of almost like a lynching crowd, they're singing about how they're going to lynch that teacher. They're like, you know, it was good enough for Brady. It's good enough for me.
Right.
To the tune of give me that old time religion.
Mm-hmm.
So he's being bracketed with, you know, it was good enough for Moses. It was good enough for, you know, and so he's being bracketed with those wise men of old. And he won't even eat less in the heat, as his doctor said, because he's going to do what he wants.
Yep. Yep. And that's true. And then, you know, it comes out during the trial that he did feel like he was a prophet.
Yeah. Right? Poor guy.
Yeah.
Feet of clay.
Tough deal. Tough deal. Also,
wasn't it during the speech about, you know, which I have to say was brilliant, you know, sponges?
Oh, yeah.
Because he asks, all so-and-so asks is to be allowed to think the same as a sponge. Mm-hmm. And doesn't everybody in the courtroom clap?
Yeah, I think so.
Because it's like, wow, excellent point. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And it was a good point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting stuff. It's, I don't know, lots of argument, right? You know, what we got to figure out is we need to all just live together. Because we're never not going to have argument. That's another thing I was thinking about in this thing. You know, we do have two sides in this country. And, you know, that's an unnuanced way to say, you know, that we have two sides. It's much more complicated than that. But... we do have to figure out how to get along with each other. And I don't know. It's like, you know, does this give me hope or does this not give me hope? You know, Drummond gives me hope. Drummond gives me hope that that's the way to move forward. You know, I liked his attitude and I liked his viewpoint on the world, which I think that I share. So that's probably why I like it, right?
Well, so, but he's clearly the hero. He's the moderate between all the sides, you know. He's the one who's striving against great struggles, against great difficulties, and overcomes them playing their own game with his reasonable, logical attitude.
Right.
So we're supposed to think like him. And in that, I agree with the movie. We should all be more like him. He is more open. And I think there's a book that I've mentioned before. When you said, how do we all live together? We have to allow each other the right to be wrong.
Mm.
We have to say, I may not think your way, but you do have the right to be wrong. You can think how you like. And I would say in that, we have people from all sides who are not willing to do that. You have the extreme conservatives, the extreme progressives, the extreme religious people, the extreme atheists. You know, there's a whole bunch of us who are in the middle, which is maybe more like the townspeople. Maybe I was giving them too hard of a time, where we're like, well, yeah, we have our faith or our science or our whatever, but we just want to get along with everybody. And that's not saying no to what you believe.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. It shouldn't be anyway. Yeah. And then you think about, you know, the limits of things like, you know, we Catholics, you know, with abortion, for example, you know, we step out into the public square and say, you know, hey, you shouldn't do that. But again, we've said here before, you know, there's abortion is one of those things that's, it's not negotiable. Once you come to a conclusion as to that's being murder,
right?
How can you negotiate about that? So yeah, we're going to fight about that. But then there are other things that, you know, maybe are negotiable, that, you know, hey, if you're Catholic, you shouldn't be doing that, but we can understand that, you're not Catholic, you know, and maybe there shouldn't be a law against that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's there's a lot of that talk going on, you know, in my head too as I watch this film.
Well, I would also say, even with things that you feel are non-negotiable, and abortion being a huge one, you should always, it's Peter, I think, that says, always be ready to give a reason for your belief or your faith. Mm-hmm. Well, you should always be able to understand where the other people are coming from, so that even if they don't agree with what you say, you can show them that you also understand what they care about. So you're shedding light and not heat on an argument. So if what they care about in, say, abortion is being kind to the mother, and what you can kind of communicate, I agree, here's how we would do that. We would, you know, we have places where, you know, like we'll help them while they have the baby. We'll help them get the baby adopted. We'll help them, you know, through all these various things. Even if they don't agree with that, they can at least see that you're not a monster. You can understand how they feel about that person. You just also care about the baby. They may see a collection of cells. I see a baby. So you can kind of at least come more to the, that's how you come to Drummond's point. You know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because they aren't monsters. I mean, some people are so rigid, they're just as bad as the fundamentalists. But these people at heart, at basis, at least began, even the ones who are so rigid, began by caring about somebody or you know, having something happen to them. So you've at least got to try to go there. You can't force people to change their minds, but you can show them who you are, too.
Mm.
You have to allow yourself that.
Yeah. Yep, that's a good point. Yep, it's also complicated.
Well, and that's why we have to, that's the right to be wrong. Will you allow me that if I allow you that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we, and like you say, you have to, there are things you have to take a stand about, but you can always be ready to explain the reason for your belief.
Yep. Well put.
Yeah, thank you. I'm cobbling it together from many higher sources.
You bet. All right. Well, do we have anything else we want to say about this movie?
No.
Okay.
I think that's pretty much, all my notes are covered.
All right, good. As are mine. I did enjoy it. I did enjoy the movie. I do love Spencer Tracy, like I said. Gene Kelly was a pleasant surprise. When I first watched, I was like, isn't that Gene Kelly? And there was no singing, not enough rain for sure.
Well, it was nice to see him do something. He was in a broader role, so that was wise, but it was nice to see him being nuanced within that role.
Yeah.
Expressions on his face and that sort of thing. It was nice to see him really acting. Also, Frederick March is somebody who's been largely forgotten these days, but he was a big actor in his time.
Oh, okay.
He did, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, he was in The Best Years of Our Lives and James all these Brady, things as the star.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were... We wouldn't look at that and say they pulled a great actor, but they did pull a great actor.
Yeah.
And Spencer Tracy is the one everything was waiting on. All these people were ready, but no one signed until Spencer Tracy did.
Oh,
and
really?
That pulled everyone. And that's a common thing, too, in Hollywood. Look, we have a name. Oh, okay.
Yeah, let's do that. Cool.
I would say for me, the pleasant surprise was Dick York.
Yeah, I was going to say, wasn't everybody waiting on Dick York to sign?
Yeah. No. That was before Bewitched.
Oh, okay.
And I was watching, I saw the name and I went, oh my gosh, Darren from Bewitched.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter went, the one who kind of disappeared, no one knew what happened to him. I said, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, Bewitched is famous for changing that actor. I have no idea what the details are, but one season it was Dick York and then another season it was somebody else playing the same role and they didn't mention anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But he did do a good job.
Oh yeah.
In the role he was there for. I mean, he did
so too.
You know, it wasn't where he got discovered, but it was funny. I went, he was in this movie?
Oh, right. Goodness. And Harry Morgan is so distinctive.
Oh yes.
Yeah. That voice. I do love that man. So that was fun to see him. And then Claude Akins.
Yes.
Not a typical role for him.
Sheriff Lobo.
Yep.
Well, except it wasn't a typical role, except it kind of was. He was the heavy.
Hmm.
And remember Rio Bravo?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, where he was the brother.
For some reason, I just constantly see him in a jovial, comedic role.
Because he was Sheriff Lobo, didn't they have a monkey with it or something? Yeah. I don't know.
And wasn't he in some Disney shows too?
Oh, maybe so.
Maybe that's where I've seen him the most.
He made a good acting as, you know, that, hey, it's that guy.
Right.
Who we happen to know his name.
Yeah.
So. Yeah,
that's cool, too. And Norman Fell. Norman Fell was in it.
Yes, I know. Yeah. I never recognized him, though. Mr. Roper from Three's Company.
That's right.
All these people went on, and Harry Morgan spoke, and I was like, I knew that name from somewhere. Dragnet.
Yeah. I love it. For me, he's MASH.
Oh, that. Okay, right. You're right.
Yeah, but he was Dragnet.
Yeah.
Yep, just that's the facts, man. But he was the sidekick.
To Friday.
Right.
Joe Friday.
You bet.
Yep.
Very good. Well, thanks for watching this movie. It's fun to talk about, even though, you know, I feel like these are heavy issues. This is just the way it is, the way we humans are, and just trying to navigate.
Well, and I think from reading St. Augustine.
Yeah.
We're always like this.
It's fascinating, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. It's fascinating to read something that's that old that could be written today, you know, and again, it's like, I'm heartened by that and I'm disappointed by that at the same time. It's like, you know, we have this nature and, we still have the nature, 1500 years later, we still have it.
You know? Yeah. I guess I'm not disappointed by it because I never expected to be better.
Well, don't you think that at some time in the future we'll all be wearing, you know, one-piece jumpsuits and we'll all be of one mind?
I have been watching Star Trek first season with Rose, and I would say you would think that, but they seem to have a lot of arguments with everybody on their ship, too.
They do. They do.
There was an ambassador who just recently wasn't going to let Captain Kirk search for his crew members long enough when they were disappearing.
Uh-huh.
You know, right. And I grant that he had the greater good in mind for his own planet, but come on, we should all agree everything.
You bet. That is funny stuff. Well, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, coming attractions.
Oh.
Our next book.
It was the best of times.
Yes.
It was the worst of times.
Good stuff. A Tale of Two Cities.
Oh, man. Yep. I have to say, I just finished rereading it because, like I said, we went away for the weekend. It was our anniversary. And,
oh, yeah.
It rained one day. So I was like, oh, I didn't bring enough backup books. But I did have A Tale of Two Cities. So
that's
I spent
great.
A lot of time reading it. And then I just couldn't put it down. So I hope you like it as much as I do. I forgot. It was so good.
I am really excited. So good stuff. So I have started it, but now I'm going to start spending a lot of time with it.
Yes, you have to.
Yep.
It's not super long, but it's not short.
Not short at all. Yep. I'm into it, though, and I enjoy it. So
good.
Okay. And then, so that'll do it. So we'll see you all in a couple of weeks. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everybody.
All right. We'll see you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.